Hello, my name is Fiona Moore, and I'm in conversation today with Mark Nathaniel Mead. Mark and I struck up an email conversation last year about how letting go of emotional and mental baggage can precipitate a profound healing response, even in the body. And since then, I've been reading Mark's blogs, and I've been impressed by his ability to write about the science behind how nutrition helps heal our body, including the healing of cancer. And he writes in a way that he makes the science easy to understand. Not only this, I find that Mark has a clear insight into the emotional and psychological dimensions of illness and how the traditional Western medical approach to treating illness and disease fails to draw on the vast healing intelligence that lies within every one of us. So I'm really looking forward to having this conversation with Mark today, and I'm excited to bring you his work. Let me begin by giving you an idea of Mark's background. Mark is a teacher, an author, and nutrition educator who has worked at 4 integrative medicine clinics over the past 20 years. He has a master's in nutrition and is a research consultant for the Institute of Integrative Cancer Research and Education. He has worked closely with leading authorities in the field of integrative cancer medicine worldwide, who are using a diverse range of innovative cancer treatments. Mark has contributed to various publications, including Breast Cancer Beyond Convention and Life Over Cancer. He currently has over 40 articles listed on PubMed, including papers published in the International Journal of Cancer, and many more. His latest books include The Medicine of Light and Living in the Clear, both to be published in the summer of 2014. Now, it's important to say that this conversation is not intended as medical advice. It is, though, going to be a fascinating look at what can be done to heal the body without medical intervention. Hello, Mark. Thank you for being here today.
Hello, Fiona. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on your show, or on the phone with you.
Yes, it's on the phone. And who knows, this could go viral, as they say.
You never know, yeah.
So before we get into some of the science and behind healing that you've observed and described in your books, could you tell us a little bit about what got you interested in the field of nutrition and non-surgical approaches to healing? In other words, how did you get from where you used to be to what you do now?
Well, when I was in school as an undergraduate in biology at Reed College in Oregon, I was interested in a more holistic approach to health, and that stemmed from my own personal experience of changing my diet when I was 15, 16, and also adopting a meditation regimen where I was meditating twice a day for 20 to 30 minutes each time, and then exercising quite a bit. And I noticed that that combination left me feeling really, really great, and that I was enjoying a very high level of vitality. And then I went to live in Holland for a short period of time with a mutual friend of ours, Dr. Martin Klotte. And I was introduced to his way of thinking about medicine and nutrition and homeopathics and natural healing, and that was very inspiring. I came back to the States and told my family, we're doing it all wrong. So I was a little bit righteous at that time, as teenagers can be, and in college, I started studying macrobiotics and other things on the side, even though my training was very rigorous and conventional. Biology program at Reed is actually the number one program in the country. And so it was a very rigorous program. But I was interested in these holistic things, so I was studying macrobiotics. I took a year off from college and went to the Kushi Institute. And all of this kind of transformed my own perspective on what good nutrition is and what can work for different people. And I tried raw foods. I tried, you know, all kinds of different approaches that were introduced, Ayurvedic approaches and so on. And this kind of, this firsthand experience I found was even a better education than any kind of academic education, because I was really learning through experience what food could do for my consciousness and for my energy and vitality. And then in 1983 and 84, as I was finishing up at Reed College, I taught classes at the National College of Natural Medicine in nutrition, and I started getting requests to counsel people with cancer. And it sort of happened naturally as a result of being identified as a macrobiotic consultant, nutrition consultant, which is basically a whole foods approach to health, various health issues. And from there, I started to notice that, you know, food alone was often not enough, that you needed other natural therapies and sometimes more orthodox therapies. But I also began to realize that that cancer was being treated in a way that was based on a number of assumptions or myths, and I started to attack those myths. And through collaboration with various medical doctors over the years, I've come to see that we really need to reorient ourselves toward this disease, because I think we're making a lot of false assumptions and or erroneous beliefs have been adopted about cancer and how to treat it optimally. So that's kind of a long-winded answer to your question, but if you like, I mean, I could talk about some of those myth perceptions, or we can talk about the treatment issues. I'm not sure where you'd like to go. It's a huge topic.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I like how you have related your personal experience that I can tell from your writing that it helps inform how you describe the science behind healing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
Yes, for me, it brings your writing alive. Yeah, so that and that is as a reader, it somehow helps the understanding as I read it.
Well, that's very exciting for me to hear that, because I sometimes feel like my sole purpose in writing is just to keep it simple and direct, because I have had I've had the opportunity to really study at a fairly high level, and so I'm often trying to distill it down to what I think are the most essential points. But thank you for that compliment.
Yeah, you're welcome. Now, one of the things that I find the most exciting about your work is that you make the assertion, backed up by scientific findings, that the conventional way of treating cancer potentially sets people up for a recurrence of cancer. Could you say something more about that?
Yeah, and this does touch on a topic that I addressed recently on my blog, which we can talk about later, but selfhealingoptions.com. And that is that, you know, the way that we are treating cancer can inadvertently or unconsciously set up conditions that encourage the further growth of the disease. So even though we're getting rid of the visible signs of the disease, we are actually creating imbalances in the body that are supporting the disease coming back. So So unless people take steps immediately after they go through conventional treatment, whether it's surgery, radiation, or chemotherapy, or in many cases during the treatment itself, in and around the treatment, unless they take those steps, it's very easy for the clock to start ticking in a way that's highly undesirable and for the disease to come back in the form of a recurrence, or what many people call relapse. And often when cancer comes back, it's more aggressive, it's much harder to treat, and in many cases it's considered incurable or terminal, because by conventional standards, there are no treatments at that point that may be effective. So people then, of course, feel very down and feel, oh, there's not much that can be done. I personally don't believe that the word cure or incurable, I think that those are misnomers, and I'll touch on that a little bit later. But to get to your basic point here, first of all, we have to understand that the tumor itself is not the central issue. It's really the unique conditions that are surrounding and pervading the tumor that control or mediate its behavior and determine or influence very strongly whether it will grow out of control or whether it will just stay as a quiet entity called the tumor. And one of the fascinating things that we're realizing about both breast cancer and prostate cancer, which are the two most prevalent cancers among women and men, respectively, one of the things that we're realizing is that when those cancers are identified at a very early stage, the tumors are not dangerous. This is a kind of a shocking realization that scientists have only made in the last 10 years, is that about 50%, by most estimates, and these are excellent estimates that have come out of Harvard University and other reputable institutions, about 50% of those early stage cancers would never progress. They would just stay as what you might consider like a wart on your skin. Okay, you look at a wart and
as high as 50%?
Sorry?
I'm just jumping in because I'm startled. Is that the statistic is as high as 50% would remain quiet if they were left
alone?
That's
right. That's right. These are very early stage tumors. In the case of breast cancer, it would be called a stage zero. These are localized and considered very quiescent. And the really surprising thing, this is going to be a shocker to many people, but there is a growing consensus among medical scientists that many of these tumors, possibly as many as 50%, would eventually disappear on their own, that they would go away without any treatment at all. Now, how does that happen? Well, it's possible that the immune system plays a role. We have evidence that there are various types of immune cells that will concentrate in the tumor under the right condition and cause it to break up and go away. That, of course, sounds really wonderful. Everybody thinks, oh, well, I'll just stimulate my immune system. Well, it's not that simple. There are many ways to stimulate the immune system, and there are many different parts of the immune system. But spontaneous remission or regression, in other words, the spontaneous disappearance of the tumor, is a real phenomenon that's been documented thousands and thousands of times, most often associated with incomplete surgery. So this is how it usually gets documented, is that somebody, the surgeon goes in and tries to get rid of as much of the cancer as they can, but they can't get rid of it all, maybe because it's too close to some vital organ. And so then a little while later, the doctor goes back and says, my gosh, the cancer's gone. What happened? Didn't do anything. Didn't do any treatment. The body got rid of it. So that's one of the clearest documented examples, and as I said, been documented thousands of times. also with fever, that when a person has a fever, it often coincides with the spontaneous disappearance of these cancers. We use the word spontaneous when we don't understand why it works. So it appears to be a miracle. But these things happen more often than we think, and as I said, with breast cancer and prostate cancer, we now have well-established evidence that this happens far more often than we realize. Now, here's the problem. When we go in with surgery, surgery is obviously traumatic. You're cutting into your body, you're creating inflammation, and you're also triggering a healing process because the body wants to heal from the cut, right? So what does it do in order to heal from the wound? It not only creates inflammation, which feeds cancer, if there are cancer cells in the area, but it will also create growth factors in order to heal the wound. And we also know that there are other things that happen around surgery that I won't go into, but I mentioned them in my article, that actually trigger a process whereby the tumor can come back as a recurrence or where the cancer can come back 2 years later on average. There's a big spike in recurrences that has been directly linked to the surgery itself.
Wow.
And to the extent of surgery. And then there's another spike that happens about 6 or 7 years after the surgery. Just briefly, one of the startling things is if people do certain things like take an anti-inflammatory or have a high amount of omega-3s in their system, which is a good fatty acid that we get from cold water fish and also from algae, if they have those kinds of things in their system at the time of surgery and they have them at a fairly high level, their recurrence rate goes down at least by 100%, in some cases by about 500% based on a recent study that was done. Just looking at somebody taking an anti-inflammatory painkiller during surgery as opposed to a regular painkiller. So these are fairly simple things that are not being done in our medical system to safeguard people against the potential for recurrence.
Yeah, I'd like to look at the ways you found that you can cultivate within the body a healing environment. But before we go there, we were talking about some of the treatments that happens in conventional medical settings that are based on myths and assumptions. You've touched on this, and I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit to, there's an assumption, for instance, that chemotherapy works. But you've discovered some of the science that happens in the biology of cells when chemotherapy is being applied that would have a different outlook, if you like.
Yeah, so, getting to the more fundamental myth perception, what I would say is that both chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery are what I call brute force tactics. And there's an assumption that when you're facing a potentially deadly disease or a very aggressive disease, that you have to use brute force tactics. You have to bring out the big guns. Or fight fire with fire kind of thing. And so we have a lot of faith in these very potent, very powerful conventional treatments, and they appear powerful partly because they create so much damage in the body. Chemotherapy is an example of that, and radiation as well. Chemotherapy, many people fear chemo because, rightly so, because it damages many of the normal structures of the body, and it damages the digestive system, and it has a major effect on the immune system. So one of the things that I talked about briefly in my article is that both chemotherapy and radiation treatment, when given at high doses, they kill cancer cells in a certain way, And the way that they kill cancer cells tends to shut down the immune system so that it is actually not, I would say shut down the immune system, I mean the part of the immune system that eliminates cancer cells.
It actually gets
turned off by high-dose chemotherapy and radiation treatments in most cases. Now, there are some exceptions, especially with low dose. When you give low-dose chemo and low-dose radiation, you actually see the immune system become more active because it kills the cancer cells in different ways. And this is being explored because, obviously, they're much less toxic treatments. But what's interesting is that when you use a high-dose chemo and radiation, which is the standard way of doing things, just blast, try to blast the tumor to smithereens and any metastases, you are switching that immune system off in such a way that if there are any surviving cancer cells after those treatments, those cells are going to be much more resistant to chemo and radiation later on. And they're going to propagate, and the immune system is not going to get rid of them because it's been turned off.
Huh.
So this is another example of why we need to think in terms of treatments that really support the immune system and attack the cancer at the same time, because those cells that survive the treatment have to be taken care of. They have to be eliminated and or coaxed, you know, to back into normalcy.
Right.
You can actually change the behavior of cancer and get it to behave normally, just kind of like how, you know, there are some sociopaths that probably can be worked with. You know, cancer is a kind of a sociopath in many ways.
That's interesting to view it that way. And I know it harks back to when I was working in the prison sector as a probation
mm-hmm.
officer, and so yes, I discovered that borderline for mm-hmm. very many individuals with the right approach could become could wake up to their, you know, their true nature, what I call their true nature.
Yeah, and this really, you know, this gets us back to what I was saying earlier, that, you know, the physical thing that we call cancer, we have to get away from thinking of it totally as just the tumor. We have to think of it more as an energetic and biochemical phenomenon, and that it's vulnerable to all kinds of frequencies or energies, including human factors like sound and light. Things that we can control, like sound and light, love, the emotion of love, diet, herbs, acupuncture, qigong, all of these are things that influence the frequency or the field that surrounds cancer. And believe it or not, there's a lot of research going on now on frequencies that influence cancer and that have very well-defined biochemical effects. I mean, probably the best example that people know is sunlight. You know, sunlight is a certain frequency, and it influences, when you go out in the sun in the morning, your body's production of melatonin increases at night, so you actually have much better protection against cancer at night as a result of going out in the sunlight in the morning, even when it's an overcast day, just the broad spectrum light hitting your eyes in the morning. And vitamin D, of course, many people know about vitamin D, and it's really a byproduct of sunlight exposure. And that one, too, is highly, strongly related to our ability to fend off cancer. And with women with breast cancer, we now know that women who get out in the sun regularly, their recurrence rate goes way down, probably because of vitamin D, but maybe also melatonin as well. So these are very basic kinds of lifestyle practices. And one of the things I'm really concerned about that I think is an important emphasis in my book that I'm looking forward to finishing, Living in the Clear, I'm really concerned about doctors telling people, we've got it all. You know, we got it all. You can just take it easy. You know, you're cancer-free. We all want to believe that phrase, cancer-free. You know, and we see it, we tend to see it as a kind of a medical guarantee. My doctor just said it. My doctor is well trained and studied, and they must mean that I'm free of cancer. Well, you know, unfortunately with cancer, you know, when you're told that the cancer is gone, they're only talking about all the physical signs of the cancer. It's really the microscopic aspects of the disease, those little tiny clusters of cells that are hiding away in different parts of the body. Those are the parts that we want to get rid of. And when you go through conventional treatment, the most important part is what you do immediately after the treatment. Instead of just going out and celebrating with, you know, as many people do, with alcohol and cake even, you know, I would say that's the time to be most rigorous with your healthy lifestyle and natural healing methods.
Yeah.
And to try to sweep up any residual cells, any cells that have survived the conventional treatments, and boost the immune system in such a way that you eliminate those residual surviving cancer cells. That puts you in a much better position to be in the clear for the rest of your life.
Beautiful. And what would you say, I know this is a big field, but the fundamental approach with nutrition for helping build that environment where the body is best set to recover?
Mm-hmm. The best approach, well, that's a big subject, and it really depends on the type of cancer. I'm not trying to dodge your question at all, but I would say that, boy, this really gets into some of what you and I were sort of touching on about patterns of eating and breaking old patterns. I would say, first of all, one of the biggest challenges that people face is changing the amount and type of fat in their diet, the dietary fat. I have a dear friend who's been battling metastatic breast cancer for quite a long time, and she's doing great. She's really in great shape. She sent me an email this morning. She said, you know, I just read this thing about smart balance, and I really love my butter, but I haven't had it in a long time because you told me not to, but you know, look at all, they're saying all this bad stuff about Smart Balance, which is an alternative to butter. Maybe I shouldn't mention any brand name, sorry about that. But anyway, I said, well, you know, butter is loaded with saturated fat, and, you know, in her case, in her particular diagnosis of breast cancer, there is a lot of research indicating that the more saturated fat you consume in your diet, regardless of the source, the more aggressive the disease becomes and the higher the recurrence rate. It can increase by 300% with a high intake of cheese and butter. And I said, look, you know, this is an old attachment that you have to butter. Butter is an old comfort food for this woman, as it is for many people. And they like butter on their popcorn and on their, you know, bread and all of that. But I said, this comes with the territory of your diagnosis. You have to make a decision. Are you willing to let go of your attachment to butter? It's a very, very hard one to break free of. And what I have found is that it takes about a year, at least a year, of complete abstinence from butter. Sounds like some kind of religious thing, but, you know, complete avoidance in order for people to actually come to a new relationship with fat, you know, saturated fat. Sugar is a big one. You know, I have many people, depending on their diagnosis, and my experience in working at these various clinics is that when people avoid anything that will spike their blood sugar, whether it's white bread or cookies or cake or sugar or of any kind, and they do certain other things that are herbal that disrupt the metabolism of sugar in the cancer cell, what we find is that metastases are disappearing, like metastases in the liver, in the brain, they're going away. So food is incredibly powerful in what it's capable of doing. You know, it gets back to what I was saying about the brute force tactics. We assume that you need to hit the cancer as hard as possible with chemo and radiation, but you'd be amazed at what can happen with just food and herbs. I'm not saying put all your trust in just food and herbs. I'm saying that they have an amazing power to not only change the behavior of cancer, but actually to get it to just go away. And so, you know, those are two examples, the sugars and or the different carbohydrates and the fat. But nutrition is such a complex subject. I mean, I could speak for hours and hours on nutrition. You know, I think one of the things I encourage people to think of is that, you know, everything is nourishment. Food is nourishment, but also the things that we breathe. If you're smoking, that is not nourishment. That is counter-nourishment. And we have many studies now that show that people who keep smoking after a diagnosis or take up smoking, their cancer becomes far more aggressive. And this is a big mistake that people make. They think, oh my gosh, I have the diagnosis, I've been smoking, oh, it's, you know, what's the use? It's not going to change things now. Well, actually, no, it does. It changes everything. If you stop smoking, the research shows that your prognosis improves greatly. And the same thing with food. If you change your food and do some of the things I just mentioned, it changes it greatly. But there are other things that nourish us, like music and movement. You know, activity is extremely important. Getting out in nature and having good relationships with other people. Loving relationships, not toxic relationships. All of these things we know can affect the immune system and the biochemical terrain that feeds cancer. So it's a whole, when I say nourishment, it's really nourishment on many levels.
Yes, and that's the reorganization of all those lifestyle factors. It comes down to a relationship with ourselves. This is what I'm hearing.
Yes.
Yeah. And
very much so. You have to put yourself first. And many people get confused and think that's a selfish kind of thing or a narcissistic kind of thing. But your relationship to yourself is primary. And you have to really value yourself enough to say, you know, do I really want this life? Would I like to live more fully? And many people are surprised by how cancer shifts their consciousness in such a way that they become much more connected to who they are and what they really love in their life. They really start to think more about what it is that really feeds them at deeper levels. And, you know, that happens when you face your own mortality, you know?
Beautifully said. I couldn't agree more, Mark.
Yeah.
I know you're working on maybe a couple of books right now, two books to be published this year, The Medicine of Light and Living in the Clear. Could you say a little bit about each book?
Yeah, The Medicine of Light is being published by a nonprofit organization called the Natural Health Foundation, which is at this point is kind of a fledgling organization in Holland, and they hired me to write this book and research it. I wrote it with a gentleman from Moscow, Russia, who is a very esteemed scientist in the field of what's called photodynamic therapy. And this is a way of treating cancer that is getting a lot of attention in Europe, where many trends start for natural healing. They start in Europe mostly and also in China. And this is a photodynamic therapy is approved in the United States for skin cancers and for a few special situations, especially as what's called palliative treatment after chemo and radiation have not succeeded. And what it does, it's really interesting. It's based on the principle that chlorophyll-like molecules, so chlorophyll is what makes plants green, right, that pigment in plants. And what chlorophyll does is it captures light. It captures light energy, and it converts it into a chemical form. It converts it into a form that plants can use. Well, it turns out that humans have their own version of chlorophyll in the body, and we can also use chlorophyll-like compounds to do this same thing. And then you take that energy that comes from light, and it is directed into the cancer cell because these compounds concentrate in cancer cells. They concentrate in them selectively. They don't concentrate in normal cells. It's almost as if the plant world wants us to survive. You know? I mean, there are so many substances in plants that selectively kill cancer cells. I can't tell you. There are thousands that have been identified that selectively disrupt the metabolism of cancer and leave normal cells untouched.
Fascinating.
And so these light-activated compounds, this is what photodynamic therapy is, and it's extremely exciting. I think it's going to become the number one way to treat brain tumors, both metastatic and regular brain tumors like glioblastoma. I think bladder cancer, lung cancer, head and neck cancers, these are all responding incredibly well. And recently there's been a lot of research indicating that breast cancer too responds very well. So that's the medicine of light is all about light-based therapies, mostly photodynamic. There's also photodynamic diagnosis because when you activate these compounds, you can see the cancer much easier when you do surgery or if you'd like to treat directly with the light therapy there. So it's a fascinating approach. The other book is Living in the Clear, and that's my based on all my years of experience of working with breast cancer, and I'm also talking about ovarian cancer and some other female cancers in there. I'm very excited about that book, and that touches on some of the things that we've talked about today.
Fantastic. Where can people get a hold of these books, Mark?
You know, this is the first time I'm doing this, but I've decided to self-publish both of these. So I'm helping the Natural Health Foundation get self-published. They'll both be available on Amazon. We're self-publishing through what's called CreateSpace and also Kindle Direct. So they'll be both ebook formats and I should correct myself on that. The Medicine of Light will just be a hardcover for now, paperback, but my book, Living in the Clear, will both be hardcover and ebook through Amazon. And so self-publishing, it's kind of an exciting way to do things these days. You have a lot more control over, you know, how the book looks and all of that.
That's fantastic. Congratulations for moving into letting your work enter that arena.
Thanks. I've been hiding behind other people for a long time now in a lot of ways and ghostwriting and I shouldn't say hiding. I've been supporting other people's work for a long time. And I really enjoy doing that. But it just got to the point where I felt like I was pregnant with my own ideas and I had to birth this new set of tenets for healing cancer. And, you know, I'm very excited about, you know, how powerful simple things are, like just learning how to slow down and breathe, you know?
Absolutely.
I mean, these are amazingly, they have biological ramifications that are profound. On so many levels, and we just take these things for granted, you know. And I also think there's basic things that healthcare professionals need to tell people, like, you know, they don't have to do everything. They don't have to throw everything in the kitchen sink at cancer. They just do your best, you know. Do what you can. Make some changes that are constructive, and if you, do as much as you can to improve your quality of life and your healing power. And I think that when people do that, they're often very surprised by how long they stay in remission or keep the cancer from coming back.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to be listening over to this interview, Mark, because it's jam-packed with fascinating pointers towards natural healing. And I'm excited that you know, this conversation is part of the, you know, midwifing this information out into the world.
If you'd like to keep up with Mark's innovative work, you can go to his website, selfhealingoptions.com. Mark is also available for private consultations on how to treat, heal, and recover from cancer using nutrition and natural healing methods. Thank you for listening, and I hope you join me again in the next interview in Heal and Awaken.